Coming up on Weekend America.
As Hillary steps away, others find that giving up is not so easy.
You know, gosh, if you would ask me 19 years ago if I thought I'd still be, like, involved in this, I would have just thought, I don't have 19 years to give up for this stadium, but I have.
When to throw in the towel and when to cling to the towel. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Bill Radke. Also this hour, ethics and religious practices inside a slaughterhouse.
So we became more concerned about the lung of a cow than we were about the dignity of the worker in the processing of that cow.
Keeping things kosher amid rising food prices. And sometimes a cab ride comes with hidden charges, but not for the passenger.
Saturday, it should be known, is not my favorite night to work. Sure, I'll make more money than usual, but it comes at a certain cost.
Get in, sit down, and hold on. It's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm John Moe in St. Paul, in for Desiree Cooper. Hillary Clinton is in Washington, D.C. She is officially suspending her campaign for the White House today, calling it quits. But later this hour, we hear stories of not giving up. Folks who held on tight to non-digital photography, a crumbling stadium, and their own academic potential. So, we all know Hillary's plans. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I'm volunteering at the Cartoon Art Museum. It's part of a sketch-a-thon to raise some money for someone's medical bills.
I'm going to be going to graduation parties like crazy.
I'm working like crazy because I'm super poor and I have no money, so I blew it all on a cruise.
I am taking the SATs, watching a French play, which I'm not going to understand a word of.
Grocery shopping, breakfast, goofing off. There's going to be a nap involved, I'm sure.
I'm going to be revising my thesis dissertation this weekend.
What's your thesis on?
I study the evolution of ankles.
Wow, which came first, walking or ankles? I've never thought about that.
You know, it's everybody needs a job, and his is to study. I love the guy who planned a nap. That's so forthright. Those voices came to us from San Francisco, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, across America today, Jews will sit down for a Sabbath meal, and the chances are they have paid a hefty premium for their kosher meat. It's not just that food is getting more expensive for everybody. Last month, the largest kosher meat processing plant in America was raided by immigration agents. They arrested around 300 workers, about a third of the plant's workforce, and this has significantly slowed the production of kosher meat. Reporter Kyle Gassett visited the site of the plant, Postville, Iowa, and he tells us what happened.
Postville is not like any other Iowa town. Sure, the streets have German names, and cornfields stretch out in every direction. But on a recent Sunday, the park was full of Orthodox Jewish boys playing baseball and Latino families picnicking. Not exactly a Grant Wood painting. Postville is home to agriprocessors, which provides 60% of the country's kosher beef. It's also the biggest employer in the region with a largely Latino workforce. Last month, the plant was raided by immigration officials, and a third were arrested. Leah, who wouldn't give her last name, is one of the Orthodox Jews that now lives in the town. She believes the plant was singled out.
And it seemed to be, you know, ironic that this is the biggest raid in the history of the United States. It happens to be at the largest Jewish kosher plant in the country.
The raid has hurt plant operations, but it's also been a blow to the local businesses that cater to the workers. The empty aisles in the town's Latino grocery give you a good idea about how things have changed. Owner Juan Figueroa moved to Postville 5 years ago because business was so good.
I was doing very, very good till this, you know, raid happened. So,
how many customers did you have a day before the raid?
No idea, but I know my sales is half of that. Half of whatever it was.
So half of what you're making now, half what you were before.
We're not really making it.
It can be easy to get the impression that the town has been a victim of federal agents. But in fact, for years, agriprocessors has been at the center of a debate over working conditions, wages, and the ethics of kosher meat. The story begins in 1973, when the former owners of the meatpacking plant closed shop. The slaughter business was changing quickly, and they couldn't afford to pay union wages anymore. 14 years later, an Orthodox businessman from Brooklyn, Aaron Rubashkin, saw an opportunity. He could reopen as a kosher plant and produce meat cheaply and sell it for top dollar. University of Iowa journalism professor Stephen Bloom wrote a book about Postville. He says the starkest difference is in the wages.
In Iowa, in 1980, a journeyman butcher who worked in a slaughterhouse, who was union, made $21 an hour. The minimum wage now is paid to slaughterhouse workers at places like agriprocessors, and that's $7.25 an hour. You don't need anything except a strong stomach and a strong back to work at a slaughterhouse.
And so jobs at the plant were quickly filled by unskilled, undocumented laborers. They wield sharp knives, slaughtering and then carving the animals as they roll by on a belt. It's repetitive and dangerous work. When he toured the plant, Bloom saw what workers endured in the kill room.
Knee-high in blood, wearing waders, sloshing around in blood that was pulsating from a steer's neck, shooting out in a geyser. You know, I would challenge any of your listeners to spend a day at a slaughterhouse and not immediately turn into a vegetarian.
In a five-year period, OSHA reported that workers suffered amputations, broken bones, eye injuries, and hearing loss while working at the plant. Slaughterhouses across the country have similar issues, but agri-processors has been subject to particular criticism, mostly by Jews themselves. A reporter for the Jewish Daily Forward named Nathaniel Popper exposed conditions in the plant in 2006. St. Paul Rabbi Morris Allen read the article and wondered if this meat could actually be considered kosher.
We became more concerned about the lung of a cow than we were about the dignity of the worker in the processing of that cow.
The Postville plant follows the accepted Jewish law to the letter. They have rabbis in the plant making sure that the animal is healthy enough to be considered kosher and that it's slaughtered properly. But Rabbi Allen believes the plant practices violate other laws found in the Old Testament or the Torah.
Also found in the Torah is a verse such as, Lo tasok sachir ani ve'avyon, you should not abuse a needy and destitute labor.
Rabbi Allen wanted to fix the situation, so he approached the owners of the plant to see if they would accept the following three proposals. First, he wanted them to bring in the Iowa Department of Labor. Second, he wanted them to provide training manuals in Spanish. And third, he wanted a delegate from his group to meet with the workers.
And I believe had they been accepted and had we entered into a process quietly from one part of the Jewish community working with another part of the Jewish community, we wouldn't be at this situation that has emerged in the way it has.
Even after the raid, the owners of the plant remain unapologetic. They still insist they check immigration status and treat their workers fairly. But the negative publicity is causing Jews to think twice it's a butcher shop. Just this year, a major kosher certification board severed its relationship with the plant. And last month, conservative Jewish leaders effectively called for a boycott of the plant's meat. For his part, Rabbi Allen has given up on negotiations. He's created his own kosher seal called Hexersetic. When Jews see it on a slab of beef, they can be assured that the treatment of the slaughterhouse workers was kosher. In Postville, Iowa, I'm Kyle Gassett for Week in America.
Well, staying with food, let's talk about two popular weekend pursuits, dining out and volunteering. Brad Berkey and his wife Libby used to be volunteer cooks at a halfway house in Denver, but they had a problem. The ingredients that they had to work with and cook with, fruits and veggies that were past their prime, that kind of thing. Now, Brad and Libby didn't want to eat this stuff, and so they sure didn't want to serve it to other people. So instead, they decided to open a cafe that could serve the same crowd that they had been helping before. They called it The Same Cafe. Same is an acronym for So All May Eat. And when it comes time to pay for your food at the same cafe, they do things a little differently. You pay what you want or what you can, and even if that means paying nothing at all. I asked Brad how customers react to that.
The look on their faces is pretty wide-eyed, you know, the first time they hear what our model is and see what's going on. It takes them a few minutes to absorb it, but after that, then it's a very positive reaction. You know, folks want to participate, and they want to, a lot of times they'll stop whatever they're doing and they'll come back and give us a hand for a few minutes, or they, you know, just ask a lot of questions and want to learn more about it.
Give a hand. What do you mean by that?
We offer folks the opportunity to volunteer here in the cafe, so anybody who wants to can, you know, take a few minutes. They can help us by wiping off tables, clearing dishes, sweeping, mopping floors, you know, anything that's going on, anything that needs to be done at that time. A lot of folks will use that as their sort of payment for the food as well. Instead of leaving something monetary or maybe supplementing what they could leave monetarily, they'll also give in terms of labor.
Did you have to go to a bank and get a loan and explain to a guy at a bank that I want to open a cafe and I'm not going to have any set prices and people can pay whatever they feel like?
We did go through that process, although we didn't come away with any money. We received a very polite no thank you. Right. So we had to self-fund the cafe through our savings over a number of years.
Do you make any money off of doing this under this economic model, or are you just a nice guy giving out free food?
The restaurant itself is organized as a nonprofit, so our goal is just to stay afloat. And for the past year and a half, we've been able to do just that. We've been able to keep our doors open, keep the lights on, pay for our food bills. And recently I've been able to become an employee instead of just a volunteer here. So now, we're able to pay a salary as well.
I could see a restaurant like this working really, really well in a very wealthy neighborhood and running into some more challenges in a neighborhood that's having more economic hard times. What kind of neighborhood are you in?
It's kind of a mixed population neighborhood. We're right in between a residential and business district. You know, there's folks on the street right outside the door, and there's also upper-end business-class people that live around here and work in this area as well. So it's a good mix. It's all over the board.
The cost of food has been rising lately. How have you been affected by that rising cost?
You know, we do soups and salads and pizzas here at the restaurant, and we make most of that from scratch. So while the cost of processed foods is rising quite a bit, the cost of the raw ingredients isn't quite as dramatic. So we've been able to keep going and keep things balanced out through that.
So, Brad, what's on the menu today?
Today's menu is we're doing a green chili made with turkey, and we're also doing a French onion soup. We're doing a spinach salad with strawberries and a quinoa with southwestern veggies. We're doing a couple kinds of pizza as well. We're doing a pepperoni portobello pizza and an apple, pecan, and blue cheese.
Wow, those sound really good. What's that going to cost me?
Well, that's the great thing. It's going to cost you whatever you think is fair for the amount that you ate. And just put that in the donation box and you're on your way.
Brad Berkey of Same Cafe in Denver, Colorado, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Same Cafe is in Denver. There's a similar pay-what-you-want cafe in Salt Lake City called One World Everybody Eats. Kirkland, Washington has the Terabyte Lounge. Same concept. People come in. Maybe they'll drop off $20 at the beginning of the week and then just get their coffee in the morning there all week long. It's, Bill, it kind of occurs to me, it's like public radio restaurants, isn't it?
Mm.
That, you pay what you think it's worth, and some people pay more.
Is the price of a cup of coffee.
I'm not doing a pledge drive here. Just an observation. You can find links to all of those restaurants at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
If beauty is only skin deep, then why not change your skin and become beautiful? Parenting in the Age of Cosmetic Surgery, next on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. My daughter turned 16 months old today, and the older she gets, the more people comment on her looks. Oh, she's got her mom's small nose. Oh, look, she has her dad's full lips. And, I can see the Chinese in her eyes. And so it begins, a lifetime of the world telling her what she looks like. In her life, I imagine some people will find her pretty, and no doubt somebody will think she's ugly, or at least not right-looking. And as a parent, I wonder how she's going to react to all these appraisals. I'm doing a monthly series about the values we pass on to our children. Today's topic is beauty and self-image. I'd like you to meet Susan Davis. She's a radio producer in North Carolina. If you're at a computer, you can go to weekendamerica.org and see what Susan's nose used to look like. Or you can just let her paint the picture.
It was very masculine looking. So it was big and it had no curves. It's kind of the only thing you saw when you looked at me. Certainly the only thing I saw when I looked at myself.
In school, Susan's classmates called her Schnoz. When she realized that her happiness was never going to come from her looks, she fed her imagination instead. She read books, she wrote. She found her happiness in a different place. Still, she was never allowed to forget what she looked like. And one night when she was 12 and her parents were out, she broke down.
And I managed to gather a bunch of photographs of myself. I stabbed myself through the face in every one of those photographs with scissors or a knife. I don't remember exactly. Stabbing and stabbing and stabbing. And my parents came home to find me in their room. I had done it in their room, curled up in the fetal position, surrounded. I was like an island in this sea of ruined photographs.
6 years later, at age 18, Susan was in a doctor's office to have a benign tumor removed from that nose. And the surgeon looked at her and said, you know, while we're at it, we could fix that. After the bandages came off, it took months for her nose to heal. And by then, she was a college freshman. And that's when, for the first time, the world told her that she was pretty.
I woke up in the middle of the night to a chorus of young men singing that. I think it's an Everly Brothers song, Wake Up Little Susie.
Yeah.
I really remember peering out of my third-story window down at this group of drunken men and not understanding what was going on, and my roommate coming in and saying to me, they're singing to you. There's a group of men outside our window singing to you. Do you know them? And it was really like that. And for a solid 10 years, I have to say, life was kind of like that. Strange men would sing to me.
Susan says it was not the singing of drunk men that moved her. It's that when men sing to you and strangers smile and want to talk to you, it starts to occur to you that the world and other people are to be enjoyed.
There's a whole sensual world that opens up. There could be a whole intellectual world that opens up that goes with the sensual world. And there's an independent life that you think, okay, I can do this. Because, you know, it seems like people want to know me. People want to talk to me. People want to hear what I think. At least people want to sit next to me at, you know, in the bar. So why not? Let me try that. Why shouldn't I try that? Whatever it is. It seems small, and you think, well, doesn't everybody have that impulse? But really, the pretty have more of that impulse.
Today, Susan Davis is a published author and a poet. How much of that is because of the inner life she developed when she was an ugly duckling, and how much because she looks good on a book jacket? She says she will never know. What strikes me about her story is that we tell our children that looks don't matter. Beauty is only skin deep. Who cares what other people think of you? It's what's inside that counts. I want my daughter to feel that way, but is it true? As you know, Susan, I have a one-year-old daughter,
mm-hmm.
and I see the culture of physical beauty and cosmetic surgery that she'll be growing up in, especially if we stay in Southern California. What would you tell your 7-year-old if she came to you as a teenager anyway and said, Mom, I want to change the way I look? Whether that's a nose job or a boob job or something else.
You know, I want to say that your boobs are different than your nose, but they're not in theory at all. I can't tell her it's a terrible idea because I just know otherwise. I would not undo this. I'm not sorry, and I don't think that my parents should have stood some ground and prevented me. If I can fund her nose job and she wants that and it's going to make her life better, that's great. But I'm hoping that she won't feel that need, that she's going to feel great about herself and her body and feel beautiful. Regardless, that's what we all want.
So if your daughter said to you, Mom, you went through this before and after experience, and what did you learn about what's important? Teach me, Mom. I want to know. I'm getting my values from you now, Mom.
Oh, God, isn't that the worst thing about parenthood? I think it's important that she's asking me this. I'm 43 now, and it's not just before and after. It's before and after, because I was, you know, an unattractive girl, and then I was a babe, and now I'm middle-aged, and what babeness I had is on the fade. It's on the decline. You know, I'm learning how the culture does and doesn't see women as they get past 40, and what privileges are slowly revoked from pretty women as they age out of a certain range of desirability. So you have to have created for yourself an inner life and a spiritual life and an intellectual life and friends and lovers and family and reasons to live that have nothing to do with being pretty, because it won't last.
Radio producer Susan Davis. Her essay about her nose job appears in a book called About Face: Women Write About What They See When They Look in the Mirror. Not everybody's cosmetic surgery experience is so positive. I chose to interview Susan because hers is a minority voice, at least in my circle. Most people I know look at cosmetic surgery with disdain. And it goes beyond concerns about safety. They see cosmetic surgery, especially breast implants, but even Botox and collagen, as acts of shallowness and self-absorption and weakness. I've been thinking about this a lot. It seems to me that changing our looks is human nature, that through history we've pierced ourselves and painted our faces and tattooed our skin and styled our hair. And I can't tell when that is a sign of poor inner self-esteem and when it's not. And that's not my job. My job is to live by my values and help my kid be happy. And I might not like how she defines happy, but that's her job, her body, and it'll be interesting to watch her figure it out. I'd like to hear your thoughts and your story at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Quitters never win, and winners never quit. It's the reflexive property of perseverance, and it's next on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe, here with Bill Radke. And it's time for your letters. Last week, we brought you a story about an online forum that talks about race. People can take part in candid discussions, ask questions, and get answers. Many of you shared your thoughts. Terrell Dunn lives in St. Louis, Missouri. When people say we are all equal, he just doesn't believe it.
For the most part, we all want this as Americans, but recent history shows that it just isn't the case. I mean, Hillary makes a comment about assassination, and suddenly we're fearing for Obama's life. So what does that say about race relations in America to me? It tells me that there's a strained politeness, and it's tinged with fear on both sides. Now, we've come a long way, and we have a ways to go, but in my honest and humble opinion, that's where we stand.
Catherine Goings wrote to us from Lansing, Michigan. She moved 5 years ago, and now she thinks about race every day.
In my former life, I lived in a very white environment, and I rarely thought about race because it rarely touched my daily life. I always thought I based my reactions on individual actions rather than, you know, the color of a person's skin. But for 5 years now, I've found myself having an increasingly hard time in my mind not generalizing about the people I see. Sometimes I wonder if the only way I cannot think on racist lines or feel like I'm being racist is to just keep a distance. But then I wonder if maybe it's just that I need to do the opposite.
And 2 weeks ago, we aired a story about veterans from older wars just coming to terms with their own wartime experiences and the sometimes uncomfortable feelings that they can now share with each other. This struck a chord with Charles Moulton, a Korean War veteran who wrote in from Knoxville, Tennessee.
I enlisted in the Navy in 1951 at age 17. All I knew about Korea was it was over there and something Russia had done. After boot camp, airman school, electrician school, I was assigned the job of plane captain. Few people realized what a savage little place Korea was during the war. The U.S. killed in action, missing in action, and wounded added up to 100 to 31 per day, compared to 63 in Nam and 15 in the current war. The war had ceased to be one of movement and had become trench warfare. We provided air support from daylight until dark, which made for long days of little sleep and lots of apprehension and watchfulness. As I watch and listen to the stories of our current warriors, I sympathize with them, for if they live to a ripe old age, they will spend at least a little of each and every day in Iraq on patrol. I have never considered myself to have PTSD, but as I look back, I think the 9 months of stress have affected my life in a negative way for more than half a century.
Well, that was the end of Charles's letter, but we talked to him a little bit more, and he shared some other thoughts with us about how he thinks those months he spent in Korea have affected him.
I think it's made me more short-tempered than what my natural personality would have been. And that's led to problems with my siblings. I guess it's turned me into a loner. Well, you can see it kind of bends people out of shape. But I think the disadvantages of the stress were more than offset by the GI Bill and the advantages of going to college, you know, and I was able to send my own kids through college. And that would not have been the case had I not gone to Korea.
That's Charles Moulton of Knoxville, Tennessee. He went on to get a double master's degree through the GI Bill and says he's concerned about whether soldiers from the current war are getting the resources they need and the opportunities they deserve when they return to the U.S.
We love to hear from you. We hope you'll send us a letter or a comment when you're with us at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with John Moe.
Today, as I suspend my campaign, I congratulate him on the victory he has won and the extraordinary race he has run. I endorse him and throw my full support behind him.
That is Senator Hillary Clinton announcing today the end of her presidential run and endorsing the Democratic Party nominee, Senator Barack Obama. Both candidates have been intensely committed, both of them unwilling to quit, even when in one case people said it was time to surrender. So now we pay tribute to people who have fought tough battles. We bring you stories of Weekend America listeners who would not give up no matter what. We start with Judy Davids in Royal Oak, Michigan.
My husband and I met in high school, actually. One of the things we had in common was a love of baseball, and we fell in love, actually, at a place called Tiger Stadium, which was the home of the Detroit Tigers baseball team. And we spent many, many, many summer nights on dates there. One season, we went to over 61 games. We always sat in the same seats in the lower deck, right field bleachers, and met some pretty famous and infamous people there. One time, Tony Tennille from the Captain of Tennille sat in our section, and it's the place that we fell in love with each other, with a team, with a city, and with a stadium. So, 1989, we were leaving the stadium, and we were approached by this tiny little Irish woman who was passing out flyers that said, "Save Tiger Stadium." I didn't see that there was a reason to build a new stadium and waste a lot of money on it when it was perfectly fine. And, you know, maybe it was selfish of me to want it, but I wanted to preserve that part of my history. A lot of people thought we were nuts, and they're like, "What are you doing? You know, you can't fight City Hall. You know, get over it, get on with your life." But we couldn't. You know, gosh, if you would ask me 19 years ago if I thought I'd still be, like, involved in this, I would have just thought, I don't have 19 years to give up for this stadium, but I have. In the end, we did lose, and a new stadium was built. And, you know, one of the bad things about fighting for something and something very public is that you are perceived as kind of a loser when it's all over. But on the other hand, I have, you know, learned a lot, and now I'm basically fearless.
This is Alexander Thompson. I live in Gloucester, Massachusetts. I'm a photographer working in film here, and for many years I've been resisting the movement towards switching to digital. It makes my spine tingle to think about it. When I'm in a beautiful situation with a beautiful setting and the light is right, like a constellation coming into alignment of the different elements of the picture, and when I feel that that's happening, I can tell right when I hit the shutter whether I have it or not. There's a few photographs that I hit the shutter, and literally at that moment I find myself restraining myself from just jumping up and down, because I know that I got the right shot at the right moment. I've been urged to give up film many, many times by people for many reasons, both, you know, creative and economic. But I just love the way film looks. I'll never give up the film photography.
When I was in grade school, every year you would be given a series of so-called intelligence or aptitude tests. The guidance teacher told me that he wanted to speak with my parents. He showed my parents the results of these tests, and he said, "Based on this, I think Richard ought to be placed in the vocational school because he doesn't appear to be very bright, and I don't think he's going to make very much out of himself when he grows up." My parents sat there like the heads on Easter Island. They didn't utter a word. And I took their silence to mean that they were agreeing with what the teacher had to say. so right there and then, as angry as I was, I determined that if it would be the last thing I ever did, I would succeed. If I had a lot of homework to do, I said, it doesn't matter. If I had to stay up all night to finish the work, it didn't matter, because I was determined that I would show the world that I am a rather bright fellow, and yes, indeed, I have been quite successful in my chosen field. I have a bachelor's degree in biology, a master's degree in experimental hematology, and a PhD in experimental hematology. I'm just really happy that I was smart enough to understand that you do not have to do or listen to what people say if it goes against how you truly feel. And I believe that people who end up as being successful do so because they steer their own course.
Steering his own course there, Richard Krueger in Mansfield, Massachusetts, Alexander Thompson in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and Tigers fan Judy Davids in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Okay, now, we all know this. The price of gas is soaring. I believe it's now, I checked this morning, I think $240 a gallon, something like that. Is that what it is in L.A.?
More for premium.
Yeah, more for
in L.A.
premium.
It's more than that.
Yeah. This summer, we are going to do the traveling for you on our show. We're having people go all over the country, and then you can listen on your radio for free or for a reasonable donation to your public radio station. Mm-hmm. Now, today, we have another installment in our summer travel series, and we're heading for the country. For some people, especially city folk, baling hay or feeding chickens is not a task, is not a chore, is not work. It's fun. It's a thing you like to do on a vacation. If you're one of those folks, there is a farm in Woodstock, New York that you are going to love. Now, this isn't a typical farm. Don't expect fresh bacon on your plate in the morning. Don't really expect bacon at all, ever. Reporter Christina Russo takes us there.
On a sunny afternoon in a grassy corner of a farm in the Catskill Mountains, a two-month-old baby goat named Clover is tottering over toward farmer Jenny Brown.
Clover! What are you doing, my girl?
Jenny took a roundabout route to the farm. She grew up in the city, Louisville, Kentucky. But during a debate class in college, she got exposed to radical animal rights philosophies. She became convinced that animals are individuals who deserve as good a life as any of us. After college, Jenny worked in film and television. In 2002, she went undercover to document conditions at Texas stockyards.
Seeing how these animals live broke my heart and made me realize it's emotionally exhausting. I wanted to be a part of the healing. I wanted to do something for these animals and to start being a voice for them and to help as many as I possibly could.
What she did was create the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary in New York. It sits on a 24-acre swatch of land with red barns, chicken coops, and a spread of hay. And lounging, mooing, and clucking all around, 100 rescued goats, pigs, turkeys, ducks, chickens, cows, and sheep. Jenny gives each animal a name, like Albie, a medium-sized white goat. He was found roaming around Brooklyn after apparently escaping off a slaughterhouse truck. His leg was infected, and eventually it had to be amputated. Jenny could relate. She lost her leg to a malignant bone tumor when she was 10 years old.
You know, I mean, I have a special bond with him. It's kind of he and I against the world, and nothing's going to stop us. And I want him to run on the rocks out in the pasture and to be able to get along with the other goats and protect himself and fend for himself when little fights break out in the goat herd. I want him to be able to live as normal of a life as he possibly can.
Like Jenny, she has a prosthetic leg and is now working with her own doctor to get Albie one. It's being donated, but would normally cost roughly $7,000. It's arguably a lot to spend on one farm animal, especially considering billions of them are slaughtered every year worldwide. But Jenny wants to set an example, and she hopes visitors to the farm will rethink what's on their dinner plate.
this is where bacon comes from, this piggy that's nuzzling you and that you can give a belly rub to, or this sweet chicken that you can hold in your arms. You know, she's killed for your chicken McNuggets that you buy from McDonald's. It's a unique opportunity to not get on a soapbox and preach to them, but to allow them to see how sentient these animals are and how capable they are of, you know, the gamut of emotions, just like your dogs and cats.
And the animals at the sanctuary have the freedom to just, well, be. Chickens take dust baths, goats butt heads, cows graze all day, the turkeys just waddle around, and the pigs, they not only languish in great big mud ponds, but get an occasional good old-fashioned belly rub.
It's a good life for a pig. Lazy days. My sweet girl. Those are happy grunts.
In Woodstock, New York, I'm Christina Russo for Weekend America.
Well, Albie the goat got his prosthetic leg yesterday, and this is his first weekend trotting around on it. If someone who speaks goat can pass along our congratulations, that would be really terrific.
Enjoy that, Albie.
Enjoy it, Albie. Next weekend is the Animal Sanctuary's second annual June Jamboree with food, music, dance, and kids' activities. Human kids, not goat kids. Photos are at weekendamerica.org.
Albie will be using that leg in warm 87-degree weather there at Woodstock Farm, isolated thunderstorms. Here's more weekend weather now with Stephanie Curtis.
Sun in 94 in Tupelo, Mississippi, holding the annual Elvis Presley Festival. Tupelo is the king's hometown, after all. Although when Elvis was born, they didn't have an Elvis lookalike pet contest like they do today, or an Elvis tribute artist show. They didn't have an Elvis 5K race either, because it would have been weird to have all those events in honor of a newborn baby. On Hawaii's Big Island, it is, as ever, sunny in 84. That happens every day. But Coffee Fest Hawaii happens only once a year. See new products, get hands-on coffee-making tips, and drink tons of coffee. Then get stressed out from caffeine, then realize you're in Hawaii and relax again. You could go back and forth like that all day. Folks in Broadus, Montana are enjoying sun in 68 degrees as they listen for a metallic ping sound. It's the Powder River Buffalo Shoot, where you aim and fire at metal targets ranging from 250 to 1,000 yards away. Metallic buffalo used to be abundant on the Montana plains, but hunting and rust pushed them to the brink of extinction. True story. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Stephanie Curtis for Weekend America.
A New York cab driver hears all sorts of crazy things from passengers, and when she has a tape recorder, she can play them back for the whole world to hear. Too bad for them, good for us. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe with Bill Radke. If you have a regular 9-to-5, Monday through Friday job, you are relaxing this weekend, hopefully having some fun, maybe going out. But in order for that fun out to happen, there have to be people working, people who are cooking your meals, or threading movies into projectors. Or...
How are you going to smuggle Sour Patch Kids into the movie theater if there's no one there to sell them to you?
Someone's got to sell them to you. Someone's got to see whether or not you have them.
Yes.
It's an economy. It's a whole system. Or, you know, there's also the people who are driving the cabs, getting you around town to those clubs and theaters and restaurants. We have been bringing you a series of stories called Weekend Shift. We're focusing on people who are working on the weekend. And today we go to New York City, where most weekends find cabbie Melissa Plout behind the wheel.
Saturday night, and I'm stuck in traffic again. But as I steer my yellow cab down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, traffic is the least of my worries. Saturday, it should be known, is not my favorite night to work. Sure, I'll make more money than usual, but it comes at a certain cost. The later the hour gets, the drunker, more strung out, and generally more obnoxious my passengers can become. And the more people drink, the more likely someone will puke in my back seat, or skip out on the fare, or even rob me. Still, I go to work expecting the worst, but hoping for the best. My shift, which runs from 4 p.m. to 4 a.m., starts out pretty mellow, ferrying Saturday afternoon shoppers between stores.
So what are you up to today?
Well, I went to the flea market, and everyone asked me if I was a dealer. I bought so much. I said, no, I'm just a shopaholic. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do drugs.
Uh-huh.
I said, but I shop.
But you shop.
By 8 p.m., I've already made what seems like 100 trips to Bloomingdale's, Barney's, and Bergdorf's. The thing about driving a cab, though, is that it's utterly unpredictable, and every shift is truly an adventure. From psychics to psychiatrists to psychotics, everyone in New York eventually takes a cab. And most people are surprised to see me, a young, white American woman, at the wheel.
Oh, it's nice to see a woman driver. They're much better than men.
Yeah, I agree.
Before this, I was stuck in a late 20s rut working an unfulfilling corporate job that I hated. So when I got laid off, it was the kick in the butt I needed. I'd always thought about driving a taxi and imagined the New York City cab driver to be this sage-like figure that lived in the middle of all the action. So I enrolled in taxi school, got my hack license, and hit the streets.
Hi, sir.
Hi.
Hi, ma'am. We're going to go to the Hudson River.
As the late spring sun begins to set, I gear up for the rest of the night, stashing my large bills in my sock and keeping my cell phone within easy reach in case anyone tries anything funny. 11 p.m., I pick up a group of lively young ladies outside Lucky Chang's, a downtown dinner theater that features cabaret performances by drag queens. The women are carrying balloons in the shape of the male and female genitalia. And for the entire 10-minute taxi ride, they lean out the window and ask everyone we pass whether they can tell what the balloons are supposed to look like.
Excuse me, sir! Sir!
Sir!
What does this look like to you? That looks like a... Woo!
I simultaneously laugh and cringe and hope their balloons don't cause any accidents. But they're harmless, and it's fun driving them.
Not gonna call me that every single day. You call me that yesterday, you call me that all Sunday.
A little while later, I pick up a good-looking black guy in the middle of an argument on his cell phone.
Done with it.
I gather from his end of the conversation that when his girlfriend gets angry, she calls him the N-word.
And don't try to justify it.
I have no choice but to listen in until he finally hangs up on her. I stay silent, trying to act like I didn't notice anything. It's always a little weird when I bear witness to such private moments. He breaks the silence to apologize for his language, and this is when, as one of my unofficial duties as a New York City cab driver, I become a cut-rate therapist.
I must have, like, low self-esteem or something, that I keep letting her back into my life.
There must be something that makes it worth it, no?
I don't know. I feel sorry for her.
After a few minutes, he falls silent, and our therapy session is over. I feel sorry for him, but there's not much I can do except take him where he's going and leave him with his thoughts. I'm relieved when he finally gets out, but mainly because it's already past midnight and nothing too bad has happened yet. The taxi gods just might be on my side tonight. Next up, a middle-aged white couple gets in. They're on decidedly better terms with each other and opt not to wait until they reach their apartment to get amorous. Explicitly amorous. It's funny, people fool around in the back of my cab almost as much as they fight. And I always wonder if they're actually getting off on the fact that I'm sitting right there. But this happens like clockwork every Saturday night. So I do what I usually do. Turn up the radio, hit the gas, and hope for a big tip.
Tomorrow night, occasional showers and breezy, the low 30.
10 minutes later, a doorman lets them out of my cab, and they take their party into more private interiors. Eventually, as the night slowly ebbs into morning, the party dies down. Contrary to popular belief, this city does occasionally sleep. I return to the garage where some of the guys are standing around as usual, swapping stories. This is my favorite part of the night. One of the guys tells how his last passenger tried to hit him through the partition with a skateboard. Another describes the junkies who took his cab to score and then ran off without paying. And another describes the accident he just had.
I go this way, she goes this way, she wants to turn it around and hits me.
I got lucky tonight. After 12 hours on the streets, nothing too bad happened to me. I settle up my earnings and head home with a pocket full of cash. It was a good shift. In New York City, I'm Melissa Plout for Weekend America.
Besides being a cabbie, Melissa Plout is the author of Hack, How I Stopped Worrying About What to Do with My Life and Started Driving a Yellow Cab. And she says that the tip that the amorous couple left her, a dollar on a $10 fare, which is just not appropriate and cruel. She has this weekend off. She's going to a friend's birthday party and seeing a show in Brooklyn tonight. You can get a tour of New York City by taxi cab, guided by Melissa. That's at our website, weekendamerica.org.
That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of this entire program at weekendamerica.org. You can bring our program with you all through the week. It can be a weekend every day. Have a great weekend.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe from Weekend America. Weekends are for changing your mind.
I started realizing, you know, well, first of all the people I'm arresting for pot are friendly. They're like people I would want to hang out with.
A former drug agent now helps users avoid arrest. Join us for the next Weekend America.